Raccoon Island over Independence Day. I caught one fish. My nephew fished in, my son-in-law fished in the surf, caught 37.
Oh my goodness.
So I give him mine and tell, so he can tell everybody he got 38.
Well, 25's the limit.
Yeah, but there were two of us, see? Okay. He was right. Keeping some for me.
All right, okay.
You know how that works.
I understand.
You know? Yeah. Okay. So we're...
We got about 20 on 4th of July out of Bell Pass.
Okay.
Pre-Sean.
Sure.
And then,
at the...
Right, the Rocks.
Rocks.
And then Friday we couldn't get out at all because of the weather. And Saturday we caught a handful. And Sunday we caught a handful.
We went out Friday and we were right in the center. The storms were all around us. Mm-hmm. And we caught a lot of catfish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we didn't bother to try Friday. It was so bad.
And then my son-in-law was taking a catfish off a hook and it nailed it. So he had a hook in his finger.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Mm-hmm. And that becomes a real... problem.
Mm-hmm.
Had to go to urgent care. Well, you can see what.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, we're good. Tested. We're good.
We're good.
We'd like, first of all, for you just to use your surname and last name,
mm-hmm.
and we'd like to have your permission to record you,
yes.
and we'd also like that permission where you understand that this is going to be put in an archive
mm-hmm.
for future researchers, students, concerned citizens. And that we plan on putting that in multiple servers. It'll be at LSU. LSU has what's called a digital
mm-hmm.
Library.
Mm-hmm.
Be at National Sea Grant, and it'll be at Sea Grant, and then a backup will be at ULL.
Mm-hmm.
And the object is to guarantee that if we something went down, we preserve the record. So we basically need you to first name, last name, and agree, and I'll start with you Monday.
Okay.
Okay, my name is Dorothy Louise Benge, and I give you permission to use whatever I have to say.
Thank you.
Robert Michael Benge, and I go by Mike, and you also have my permission.
All right. I'd first like to ask you that you're in a family business.
Yes, but we...
In a way...
It's this is a corporation. There are stockholders out independent of the family,
okay.
but the family controls 53% of the stock, roughly.
And how long has your family been in this business?
Since it started in 1928.
So we are we're an 80-year-old company.
Right.
Was it 28 or?
It was 27, 28. Actually, the Delacroix Corporation is successor
of the
Acme
Land
and Fur Corporation, which was a company that my great-grandfather, my mother's grandfather, started. And actually, there was the Southern Fur Company before that. So he was a fur buyer, owned a store down in Delacroix Island. And through the Trappers' War, which you undoubtedly heard of,
feel free to talk about.
Right. Well, that's really the basis of how the corporation started from the land side. The Delacroix Corporation, I believe, was already pretty much here, but didn't own the property or didn't own very much property, and. The merger between the Acme Land and Fur and the Delacroix Corporation, which my great grandfather sold the land that he had acquired to the Delacroix Corporation for money and for stock, and through the years we've managed to maintain the corporation. We've actually managed to do fairly well. I think my great-grandfather spent a lot of time, if you look at the records of this corporation, keeping this company afloat. He borrowed money to pay taxes. He always, he invested heavily in the infrastructure of oil and gas in the state, in the Plaquemine and St. Bernard parishes primarily. But, he struggled, I think, to keep the company afloat.
What was your grandfather's...
Manuel Malero.
Okay. Okay.
Manuel Navarro.
All right.
Yes, and he was a bootlegger. We're sort of proud of that.
Well, I think that if that's something you care to talk about, I know the I mean, there was some tension between the Malero family and the Perez family.
Oh, big deal. Yes.
And that's not a trivial matter.
Yeah. No. And that tension lasted until just a few
years. Recently. We've pretty much buried the hatchet, we think.
Well,
and I get along with both Shell and Perez Jr., Cop, and I get along with his half-brother, Shaolin. And they don't get along, but I get along with both of them. So we're good, and then I prefer to keep out with their relationship because I don't really, I know that Shaolin has a great, great deal of affection for his half-brother, but they are estranged through their family. But from the Delacroix Corporation point of view, we shared a common boundary with Shaolin Perez Sr., and unfortunately we had to go to court and spend a lot of money to maintain
and
our
it
property.
Took 11 years
so that was but years. They that was finally settled
yes.
finally settled about 5 years ago
yeah.
Of course Shaolin was dead and so we were stuck with a lawsuit with his widow or Lynn Perkins Perez and Shaolin and eventually, through mediation, we were able to recoup some of our losses, but not all of them, and establish the boundary where it was always supposed to be to begin with, and move on and say, maybe we can just say, as best you can, that this was a great misunderstanding between neighbors, and let's be neighbors and go forward. And we are. I see Shaolin at the CCA banquets, and I've sent some money for his shoot for the Tulane Medical Research Facility. I think they do some cancer stuff. So, anyway, we've buried that hatch, but we moved along. But we got getting back to this corporation. When my great grandfather died, my grandmother became president, and she had been very, very active. I think as the son that my great grandfather never had.
Yes.
being part of the business, and she became in, and she made it a point that, we were not going to live hand to fist anymore, that we were going to set some reserves aside. And she had a goal of setting aside about $1 million in reserves, just to say. And I'll tell you this, but when she became sick and my mother took over, there was more than that in reserves in this corporation. In addition, we had a great, great run of oil and gas activity through the years. We had great people working for us in the field that we were able to defend our property rights in suits like that or with the state even.
Mm-hmm.
We've got some great state water bottom case law. So it's one of those things I often hear people say about, it's navigable water, belongs to everybody. Well, that's not true, but you can say that if that's what you believe, but legally that's not the way it works.
Well, I wasn't aware of, I know the corporation, but I was not aware of the importance of women. And I think that in terms of gender studies, and you certainly understand how the role of women have changed in the last half century.
Yes.
To have a corporation, and I'm guessing, under female management probably in the 50s or earlier.
62.
Well, that's not insignificant. And it's a part of the story we never hear.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could just comment about the importance of how the female side of the family, for lack of a better word, helped this company prosper, I would really appreciate that.
Okay. Well, my grandfather died in 1962. My mother was on the board of directors, and then she was named president. And I remember we would come to read the minutes, of the old past minutes, so that we could get a feel for what was going on and what might go on. And she worked very hard, very diligently. She was committed, I would say, 100% to the job. And then Well, she did a wonderful job.
And this is without an MBA or
this
anything.
This was a high school education. She did a lot of continuing education. She went to as many oil and gas seminars as she possibly could, but she didn't have a degree. And when she decided to step down, it was in 93.
Well, she really didn't decide to step down. She had a stroke, but she said, I'm retiring.
She said it.
She invited Mom in ahead of time, before that point, and that's when she started about reading the minutes and getting an understanding of where the company's going on.
And the key was
that when she became president one day, when my grandmother became president, she had to really, even though she was on the board, she had to learn this business.
Yes.
And there was nobody to say, hey, this is how we did it. Because my great-grandfather, even though she was on the board, and he did confide a bit in her, I believe, she really didn't have a sense of the magnitude of the corporation, of the oil and gas deals. Now, she did have a good attorney. The Wilkinson family had served this corporation for generations. And Hugh Wilkinson was an outstanding attorney. Let me interrupt a moment.
You used the term Wilkinson. Now, there is a canal in southwest Louisiana coming off the west side of the river going due south towards Grand Isle called the Wilkinson Canal. Is that their family?
I don't think so. They do trace their roots back to General James Wilkinson the Revolutionary War. They were an old blue blood New Orleans family.
Okay.
And all the carnival, the
Rex.
The secret Rex. Societies, the daughters have been debutantes and queens of whatever balls. The point being that he was very, very capable and he did had a lot to do with, helping her. But she worked hard to learn this business, and she had nobody to fall back on, and that was to see her kind of relinquish some of that control, because invite Mom in to start learning and working and be the treasurer, and unfortunately it wasn't very long after that though that she suffered a stroke.
I came to work here in 1989, and. I came to learn the business, and I was trained by Harold Baker, who had been with the company for years. I mean, he knew my grandfather, so he was the treasurer, and that was to be my job, to learn his job, because he was wanting to retire for years, and my mother never would let him. it was a good time. To come, and he was wonderful. He showed me what I had to do with the books and whatnot, and so that was in 1989, and then in 93, that's when I became president.
When you look at Louisiana's marshes, particularly during the period when Muskrat was king, the best pelts either came from essentially Cameron and what was always called Delacroix.
Yes.
That is St. Bernard, generally a little bit of Plaquemine.
Plaquemine Parish, yes.
So you can address a period of time when fur was literally king in the wetlands. Prior to oil and gas.
Yes. Yes.
In some ways more profitable than oysters, but depending on the size of the lease. Can you tell us any stories about that period?
Absolutely. I mean,
I remember I was in eighth grade at St. Rose de Lima, and our history book, Louisiana history book, talked about the muskrat industry in Louisiana. And I was so proud because I was part of that. And it was the thing. That was one of the reasons. Well, my grandfather was very committed to the trappers, the trapping and the trappers, the Islanian trappers. And that's one of the reasons he did what he did with the corporation in 52, I think it was, the Delacroix board of directors did not want to lease land anymore to the trappers because they were making a lot of money with oil and gas and they felt like it was piddling. But my grandfather leased those lands from Delacroix and leased them to the trappers so they could continue to trap. So that was about 10 years that happened. And of course, you saw the fur industry change, and especially when PETA came on the scene. And not only PETA, but the Nutria was just decimated the muskrat industry because the Nutria ate the grass that the muskrat ate, and they not only ate the grass, they ate the roots too. So there was no feed. And so anyway, I've seen it, you know, from almost the beginning that I remember until its demise. The fur industry is.
Acme Land and Fur. It was started for fur trapping. This was the largest fur trapping ranch under a single ownership in North America.
Really,
150,000 acres. So it was considered to be the king ranch. The king ranch of Nutria.
I want to go back a moment because as a researcher interested in multiple things, your mom has pointed out something. I want to get a clarification. Clearly your grandfather, for lack of a better word, loved the people who worked his land.
He did.
So did he put, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but would you agree that he put the people ahead of his income sometimes?
Yes,
he did, without a doubt.
This
corporation, as he amassed the property, a lot of the property was amassed through the Fur Trappers War, but he was paying the taxes on the property. People gave him the property to pay the taxes, and they were able to, as part of this corporation, and we have documents galore to go through, to buy their property back if they so chose. Or they could work it themselves as a lease. Mm-hmm. Some people, and you'll see if you look at one of our maps, you'll see that we have a lot of land, and a lot of it's contiguous, but a lot of it's broken up. And the broken up is where people bought their property back from the corporation for what they sold it for to begin with. Never a charge up or a markup, you know. And as I said, when we were talking about, you know, robbing Peter to pay Paul and pay the taxes, well, one time it was 150,000 acres, but of course, to pay the taxes, sometimes we had to sell off property. And of course, we sold off the less productive fur trapping property. Now, that 50,000 acres turned into be the Morgan City Realty down in Plaquemine Parish, where all the oil and gas, I mean, it turned out to be the much more profitable oil and gas section of the property, even though, we've been very, very blessed with the mineral rights that we have found. So, but going back to what you said about it, you know, he put those trappers first, and then toward the end, he was basically to his death. From 59 to 62, he was basically bankrolling the trappers. He was losing money.
So would you call your it's your grandfather.
Great-grandfather.
The first humanitarian of St. Bernard?
I would think so. Believe me, biased.
So.
You know, I would think that without a doubt, you know, the stories you still hear from Celestino Nunez that grabs me at Charlie's Diner every time to tell me about how he wanted, you know, his dad wanted him to go to college, and Uncle Manuel said he'd pay for college, but that's not really what he wanted. He wanted to go to work for Bass. You know? And, you know, just things of, you know, stories like that. He put lots of people.
Put a lot of people through college.
You know. He took care of his people. There's no doubt about it. I mean, we still have Donald and Saudi, who's our quote-unquote land manager. His son-in-law really is now running the job out there, but Donald's still on the payroll, still goes to work every day, still has a great, great knowledge of this. His grandfather worked for my great-grandfather. You know, the people don't leave us. I mean, Harold Baker wanted to retire, but he didn't.
Well, you know, I if you had to put a number, it's going to be really hard.
Oh,
and the number of people that your family, going back to Mr. Manuel, have touched, how many people would it be?
Oh,
it could be
thousands.
Okay,
I think
at least a thousand.
Yeah,
I would say above 500, 600. I mean, there were not that many families down there to begin with at one time.
But
during
you look at all those trappers' leases.
Yeah, that's true.
That's a bunch right there. Mm-hmm. And then the family, you know, Lily's family, cousins, you know. Now, I will say this, that there is, this is a negative, there are some people in the parish who did not appreciate my grandfather. And I've got to say, after looking through those leases and things, the ones that purchased their, you know, paid for their leases, they paid over a 10-year period at trapping season so much, and then 10 years it was theirs. Some of them didn't take advantage of that. And oil was discovered on all those leases that these people purchased. And those that didn't purchase them, kind of sour grapes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, that's my feeling.
Well, it sounds to me like there's employment legacy. By that I mean...
Absolutely.
A grandfather gives this to his children, he gives it to his grandchildren that are getting ready. So, and those kinds of legacies are generally found in family-run businesses. Is that true?
I would say that. No, that's very true here.
You know,
that would be very true here.
And I've wondered, did the name Delacroix come from the community of Delacroix, or did
the
community get the name from the corporation?
As I said, we started out, really, he started out as Acme Land and merged with the Delacroix. I don't know if he was even on the board of the Delacroix Corporation when
he always was.
He always was.
Now, we have fur. Walk me through, we capture fur, and how we eventually get it to Steinberg, whatever. What's the process?
This building right here was a center. They would bring the furs here. The buyers would. But one time the buyers did it, and the buyers shipped it when they started the Delacroix Corporation. Then the idea was to eliminate some of the middlemen, and we became the buyer. They bought the furs here. They brought them upstairs. They sorted them. They graded them. In some cases, they even still dried them more. They bailed them, and then they shipped them to New York to be processed. So this was a complete operation.
Yeah. And the Delacroix buyers would go into the communities, and they had a schedule, and they would meet the trappers with their furs on the porches of the bar rooms, the grocery stores, in Delacroix, in the area. And they would buy the furs there. The furs came bundled in bundles of 50, and they would go through them, they'd spread them out, and they'd give them a negotiated price, and rebundle them, bring them up here to the second, third, and fourth floors, and that's when they would grade them. And we can take you up there. You can see there's still remnants of that up there.
But would you have a photograph of this building with fur in it?
I don't think so, unfortunately.
Well, you know,
I got the remnants. I got the bins where they sorted them.
What we may want to do is that Roy works with a lady who's a very fine photographer with the right kind of camera.
Mm-hmm.
I have searched federal records. There are huge files from St. Bernard. It will take me a while, but you will get a CD of every one of those images from that period, because the fur industry was huge.
Yes.
Well, it was this king. The fur trapper was the wildcatter of his day in the 20s during the Depression. I mean, I think you talked about this in your last book. I mean, he was making money.
He was making a good living.
You know,
it was selling furs for a dollar a pelt, and in those days, that was a lot of money.
Yeah, and I'd like for you to talk a minute about that, because in my case, my roots are in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
My father went from Oklahoma in the 30s to California because he got a 60% raise.
Mm-hmm.
He went from $5 a day to $8 a day.
Mm-hmm.
And you're talking a dollar a pelt.
In the 1920s.
The trapper is probably catching 200 pelts a day.
Yeah, it is a part of our history.
It's hard work, but I mean,
part of our history that you can comment on, mm-hmm. and we'd appreciate that,
mm-hmm.
because it's been forgotten,
mm-hmm.
and it's not insignificant. Now, did you have any sort of buildings in Delacroix where you would keep fur?
No. The buyers would meet the trappers, as I said, on the porches of the businesses down there, buy them, bring them here.
So you were using probably a Model A truck and delivering them.
Yeah.
Now, how did the flood of 1927, because this company was formed, did that affect what we're talking about?
Well, that was the Acme Land of Fur.
That
really
was Acme Land of Fur.
But of course, the muskrat season was completely shot when that happened.
Now, let me see. Okay, Mr. Wilkinson was my grandfather's. Hugh Wilkinson Sr. was my grandfather's attorney. And he negotiated a deal with the state for a settlement, because they were going to blow up the levee at Carnarvon. And this was going to kill the business, the fur trade. And so he negotiated a deal with the state. I think he got to get money to cover the loss for the company. What my grandfather did with the money was to buy barges and sent his trappers out to collect muskrat pairs, put them in cages, fed on the barges, and fed them until the grass and the water was gone and it was safe to let them loose again. Is he something or is he something?
This is why we're here. And I've done a lot of, I don't know that one.
Uh-huh.
So he bought, and he used the word plural. So there's
barges.
More than
barges.
One barges.
Well, I mean, you know, that's
barges and brains.
Barges and brains. And so anyway, then, you know, and he helped a lot of people. The city was supposed to pay reparations and they didn't. And, a lot of them they were dislocated. They had to go to New Orleans. And my grandfather helped a lot of those people, you know. The ones that needed it or asked, they got it from him. So he didn't really make $1 million on that deal. He spent it to save the industry.
Now, there's going to be an overlap. We've got significant trapping.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen the introduction of the nutria. There has to be a point where oil and gas comes into the question.
1939.
So right at the end of the...
1938, 1939. The first lease was...
Right at the end of what some would call the Great Depression,
mm-hmm.
and just before World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, do you remember the company that put the first well in?
Texas Company.
Texas.
Sid Richardson.
Sid Richardson, he's on the wall over there with Eisenhower.
Okay. All right.
Forerunner of the Bass Company. Bass Bobcat. The Texas Company was not with Sid Richardson.
No.
Texas Company had everything at one time. Sid Richardson had his fingers in everything.
Yeah.
And then he broke off and they had the Bass Field, which
mm-hmm. was, been wonderful.
That was the second field.
Mm-hmm.
And Because that one's still producing today.
Is there a Bass company?
They're now called Bass Oil, the BOPCO, Bass Oil Production Company, but they have gone from Bass, Perry Bass, the Richardson and Bass,
Richardson and Bass,
Perry R. Bass, Inc., to Bass Enterprises. They've changed their name several times.
The reason I ask is that during Katrina, there were a series of tanks owned by a company that was called Bass. Mm-hmm. Is that the same?
Probably so.
Yes.
Okay.
Probably so.
All right.
That's probably why they changed their name.
Well, in terms of oil leases.
Right.
The Winterlose Oil Company, W.T. Burton, LL&E, Texaco. Texaco eventually got state water bottoms, largely because of Huey Long. Mm-hmm. But during this period, Huey Long was elected in 1928, took office in 29, died in 34. So right before you're talking about, there was not a lot of electricity. There were no paved roads. Mm-hmm. The communities were isolated. There was no sewage. There was no municipal water. Do you remember how that changed? Or stories about it?
All I can remember is Uncle Stephen running into the mule and running his truck into the... Why are you terrible? I'm going to go back and chew the mule.
In the middle of the road.
but you see, when you go out to White Closet, Hopedale.
Mm-hmm. I know.
There was a railroad there at one time.
Yes,
there was.
Okay, if you can remember any stories about the railroad.
I really can't. I know it was there.
Okay.
I know as a child, we would go visit relatives in Delacroix Island. And I can remember, it was such a long trip. Oh, God, it took forever. And it was a gravel road, a shell road. And we'd go down there. It seemed like it took forever. It sounded like 3 hours or something like that. And it was a narrow road. And the bayou on the other side, on the side of the road, Bayou Terre Buff, was beautiful. It was flowing all the way from Chalmette or wherever, all the way to Delacroix Island out to Lake Leary. It was just beautiful. And then I don't remember who was in office, but they allowed people to build mud bridges across that bayou and put a culvert underneath them. And if you go there today, you look at Bayou Terre Buff, it's not a bayou.
Hmm.
It's a mess.
Now, do you remember Alluvial City?
Yes. We'd go down there to visit friends, family.
Well, I have a favor to ask. There was a post office in Alluvial City. Mm-hmm. If you might have any letter that is postmarked Alluvial City, I'll buy everybody dinner. It's been recorded. Because it's brutally difficult.
Mm-hmm.
That is...
Okay, I'm going to put you in touch with someone who wrote a little monograph on Alluvial City.
Okay.
Her name is Maria Snitzer. Maria Fernandez Snitzer. And her father was Frank Fernandez. And they lived in Alluvial City. And her father is the one who did the oral histories at Nunez.
Okay, all right.
So if there's anybody would have anything like that, yes, it would be her.
Well, we went and interviewed the Robin family,
mm-hmm,
and I asked the question, and they said, you're sitting in Alluvial City.
Yeah.
And they have some photography, and it's on my to-do list in August or September, because you clearly have Islino characteristics, and I know you're very proud of that, and you should be. If we could just talk a little bit about your Islino heritage, or some would say Canarios heritage, we'd appreciate that, because it's not well documented.
I thought it was better documented than it was.
It's getting better. It's We're improving.
But you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know. It's been, we've forgotten pages in American history.
I would say this, it's more prevalent now. I mean, here, at least in the New Orleans area, people know who the Islanders are, you know.
More and more. And just this week in the Louisiana magazine, on the cover, there's a picture, and it's a it talks about new restaurants, and at the very top of the list is the word Islanios. Islanios Cooking, Born Restaurant, is one of the top five new restaurants, and Brian Landry, who is the partner with John Besh in that restaurant, Besh and Landry opened that restaurant. Besh sent Brian Landry and his sous chef, Jerry Middleton, with us, Canarios, to the Canary Islands for 15 days, and we researched Canarian food, and they have it in their restaurant. Not totally, but some of the things. They were responsible for importing Ron Miel, which is a honey rum drink from Arucas on Gran Canaria. And it's really good. They serve it in their restaurant. You can get it down at the Mero's Quick Stop in St. Bernard. Started out at $25 a bottle and went up to $30 because he said there's such a demand for it. He can't keep it on the shelf. So, they imported cheese from the Canary Islands, wine. So we're making progress. You know, we've been at it for a while. And
it is in the Louisiana history books now.
It's in the Louisiana history books now, and it wasn't in that eighth grade book when I was in eighth grade.
Well, no, when I...
By the way,
I asked the question because it is expanding. In fact, we were in the Islenio Historic Center when you were getting ready to go on that trek.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exciting. And mm-hmm. We still like to come down mm-hmm. during the festival yeah. and try to do some interviews.
Yeah.
But when you think of St. Bernard, you think of Plaquemine, you think of your property, you think of the period, you got to have a boat. Right?
That's not how many boats I have.
Well, I think what we need to do is set the stage here that those people buying fur probably used a boat. And I want to know, what was it made of wood?
Yes.
Was it locally produced?
Yes.
Sail power? Was it used...
Motor,
but it was it. You know, a lot of them used originally at that period a Model A,
mm-hmm.
or they may have used even a Model T with a flywheel, which break your hand.
Yeah.
Can you just give us a little background of what you remember about the boats?
All I can remember is what I see.
I remember the Lightning and the Delacroix.
Okay,
those were the names of the boats.
Did Uncle Pete build them or?
No.
Somebody built them over there.
Somebody, Uncle Pete used to maintain them.
They were wooden loggers with cabins.
So it'd be like an oyster lugger.
Well, it built on that, but smaller, because they used them to patrol. The Lightning and the Delacroix were two motorboats that Mr. Adam Mellerine used to patrol the property. And they were inboard boats with inboard engines. Then my great-grandfather is... 1954, he bought a 28-foot Chris-Craft for his personal use.
Wow.
The wooden inch and a half plank was really a with two twin gray marine 455s in them. Talk about a very, very nice boat. High maintenance, but my grandmother sold it to somebody, but down the road.
Now, on your property... Particularly, and I don't know where your property ends and the Biloxi Marsh sort of.
Toward where the Mr. Go is now, which wasn't there, you know, that would be more the transition. As we move east of Delacroix Island, we start to break up. The Biloxi Marsh is primarily on the other side of Mr. Go.
Yeah.
They do have some in south of, say, south of Hopedale. And they also have a company called Lake Eugenie that they're part of. And so they've got some land.
So they're neighbors.
Right. So we're all, you know, there's different little sections all over the place.
Now,
we have some property all the way out in Biloxi Marsh, but not very much.
If you go from Shell Beach due east, I am told the Archdiocese of New Orleans had, for lack of a better term, a camp, a retreat center, and there was also apparently a boat builder out there. Do you know any stories about either one?
Mm-hmm. There used to be a place called the Priest Camp.
That would be
the Priest Camp. That's what, you know, and it was on Lake Bourne, if I'm not mistaken. It was out in the lake, the Priest Camp. I've heard the reference to that. People I've heard say it are all deceased.
Well, but yeah. Well,
Blackie yeah. Campo, E.T. Tapper talked about the Priest Camp. Used to be in Lake Bourne. He was saying the Archdiocese had a camp. And I said, well, there was something, the Priest Camp.
Yeah.
All this time I thought it was somebody by the last name Priest.
Well, I think
like Danny Priestley. Okay.
I think what it says, if we can nail it down a little better, is if we were very familiar with individual families or maybe a corporation owning a camp. Mm-hmm. And it can be various sizes. It can be tar paper hovels to something that. But to have the Archdiocese, for lack of a better term, using it as R&R, that's an important part of the story.
Mm-hmm. You might check with F.J. Campo, Blackie's son.
Son?
That's
at
running,
Shell Beach?
He's running the Campo's Marine. He would run a Robbie, would probably have heard the story, but Robbie's younger than I am. So I mean, but F.J., would, he's a, you know, he would probably know about it. Or even Big Kenny Campo, but he's not down there anymore, so... those would be two, but I'm trying to think of who else would be down there. It's, you know, when we lost Blackie Campo, that was an institution. We have a great video deposition somewhere of him that he was talking about. Property, we had an issue with Biloxi Marsh on some property, and so we were having a case, and we were preparing. We eventually settled, but in the preparations, we went to Blackie Campo as an authority. Who was what and what was kosher out there at the time.
I wonder if we could get a copy of that.
We better probably have a copy somewhere here. Yeah.
Anything, we'd like to come back clearly, but anything that you find that you care to share, those are really valuable in this sense. I'm an eternal optimist. I need you to know that.
Mm-hmm.
But if we can't save all the marsh, these stories, only one generation from now. See, I'm one generation removed from a family where my dad made $5 a day. We're just one generation. So those become important historical documents that we don't even think about today.
Mm-hmm.
And we're here to try to not only capture the stories.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking for a Steinberg fur letterhead.
We might have
one in the files. So I'm sure we do.
All right.
I mean, where did I start looking for it?
I
know there's one there.
The community of Delacroix, Hopedale, Wycloski. There's another one that are just forgotten.
Brazier.
Benchek
originally was Rajo was originally called Benchek, and that was the second settlement in St. Bernard for the Islaños, and it was named Benchek originally by the original Islaños who settled there. And it was a corruption of the word Benchiquiwa, who was a Guanche king on Gran Canaria. And then it later became called Rachel, after the Rachel family. I think she was, the lady was a very giving person and took care of a lot of the Islaños too.
Well, here's something I want you to think about. We have a Harper's Weekly dated 18 86, 87, showing the community of St. Milo.
Oh.
On Bayou St. Milo.
Yeah.
All right. That community, gone. All right. Can you think of any other communities that we may not know of that are gone? And we've just heard one that's been rebranded, renamed, that are gone. And this might be a community of five families.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, at Oak River and Orange Bayou, you had an Indian village. That today, even today, the bones are washing out of from the sinkage, you know.
Really?
So, and every time there's a 3D shoot or there's a project or you've got to have the...
permission.
You have to have the historical society or government's historical agents go out there and check for bones and artifacts and cities and whatever. So there's probably a lot of documentation, but I do know that on the banks of Orange Bayou, New River was an Indian village.
That's that picture right there.
Really?
Orange Bayou.
It's an artist's depiction of it. But there would be on this bank right here, in the middle right here. This would be Orange Bayou. This would be Oak River on this
really?
Bank.
And my grandfather had a camp. Sid Richardson built a camp for my grandfather on Oak River where Orange Bayou came into it. And it was a big camp. And across the bayou, across the river, Oak River, there was a camp built by Edwin Powell, and he used to lease it to the people who worked for Bass. And but that camp was a big camp. It was wonderful, and Betsy took it.
Hmm.
It was in 1965.
Now, do you have any property that's near the Delta? The Mississippi River Delta?
No, we don't get
really below Oak River Bay.
All right, now, do you have hunting leases on your land?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
So you have actually...
About 135.
Hunting leases. Wow. Are these like hunting clubs or individuals?
Some individuals, clubs, groups. It just depends on what they, you know. Just when we actually put down on paper who the leases were, we had 66.
Now, when was the first one of these leases executed?
Oh, golly.
I'm gonna talk about that. The first lease.
Anybody want anything to drink? I'm gonna get a cup of coffee.
No, I'm happy. Thank you.
The first leases were handshakes. Yes, and that continued. Until I became president. And, you know, and I said, well, you know, we've got to have written leases because we've got to secure the property, for one thing. We've got to be able to settle disputes over the leases. So in 93, I instigated written hunting leases. And everybody was thrilled because it gave them a sense of security as well. Because the lease was theirs, and it said on the lease where they were going to hunt, and they got a map and everything. Everybody except Shalyn Perez signed a lease. And that was in 1993. And that's how we ended up in court. Because he didn't want to sign a lease, and he was... You know, he thought, well, I can pull the wool over this little girl's eyes. And so we went back and forth. And then I had in my file a note, because Adam and Sardi used to call in his reports to the office.
Adam Mellory.
Adam Mellory used to phone in his reports after he, you know, viewed the property after he made his rounds, and the secretary would type what he said and date it and put it in the file. And what's that?
That's the leases, duck leases.
Oh. And so anyway, that was dated 19 63. And we were in 19... It was dated 63. So it was 1993, and it was like, you know, November of that year. And I figured that Shallon was going for 30 years possession to keep that. So in June, and I filed a suit because I had to do it under that 30 years. And it took 11 years to get a judgment, and then it took another, 5 or 6 years to get the settlement. Because we won the suit after going to the...
Well, the Supreme Court refused to hear it.
Supreme
Court of Appeals got a ruling.
Yeah.
And then, they went to a... They appealed to the Court of Appeal, and so it was heard by a 5-panel judge. We had a couple of judges die during the...
Yeah, so we had
process,
to go.
They had to keep pushing back.
We had to
finally
go do it again.
And then they,
in other words, once
Supreme
a judge
Court,
died
they
on the panel, you had to start over. So we did that, and finally, we won, and before I filed the suit in June, I met with Shallon. And I made one mistake. I didn't take somebody with me. I met alone. But I did. It turned out okay in the end, because when I met with him, I had my points written down, what I wanted to cover, and I specified, Shallon, my board of directors is concerned that you are going for 30 years acquisitive prescription. He says, oh, no, no, no way. So when I get on the ferry, I have my notes that I wanted to talk to him about, and I wrote a letter to him based on what we had discussed and asked him would he please review the interview and either approve it or add to it, correct it, or what. And so he read it, and he approved it. But in that interview, he said he was not... he had no idea of acquisitive prescription. And so that right there stopped the acquisitive possession. And that, when we went to court the first time, Judge Rowe, who was the judge, and who Shallon and Lynn sent his wife to law school or something, his wife was their secretary, they sent him to law school. And he wouldn't allow that in as evidence. Wouldn't allow it in as evidence, but the attorney proffered it. So when we went to appeal, on the third time we went to appeal with a new panel, they nailed him on that letter.
16 years, roughly.
Yeah.
Wow.
Perseverance. Wow. That I got that from my grandfather.
Or determination.
And my mother.
Both the work.
And my mother.
Now,
they were both very determined.
That's just the leases. We're getting ready to renew leases, and that renewal notices
August.
For the duck hunting season.
One of the things that Sea Grant has been involved in, and it based on faculty.
Mm-hmm.
You have somebody interested, you don't. You have somebody interested, you don't. Mm-hmm. Is that the recreation potential.
Mm-hmm.
of the wetlands is largely unappreciated by the non-hunter.
Right.
Right? Now, clearly this is a very important part of the business. It may not be important in generating income, or that's
it
none of my business.
It does generate.
But it doesn't generate enough income to run this corporation.
But that aside, if I use the term Purdy Firearms, you might know it.
Purdy
Firearms? Purdy.
P-U-R-D-Y.
Purdy shotguns, in my opinion, are the most expensive shotgun manufactured. I know of 3 in Louisiana, and I haven't gone looking for them. And I don't know if they were bought as new or on a secondary market. I can't answer that question. My wife and I were on holiday in London last year, She's very understanding about my quirks. Mm-hmm. I go to the Purdy Firearms Company and walk in and introduce myself. And I said, can you show me your records? Sure. Mm-hmm. I'd like to know every Purdy Firearms sold in Louisiana, but I don't need a name. Mm-hmm. I just need to know a sale. Well, sir, we have those records, but they're not digital. They're in a file that took up about 50 or 60 inches of shelf space. I said, okay, may I take some photographs? Mm-hmm. Well, sure. Mm-hmm. Just don't take a picture of a person. Mm-hmm. So there's two of them there. I take a picture and I go home. Retail value, just short of $400,000 a firearm.
Oh, my God.
That's pretty good.
Now, having found three without looking, mm-hmm. the researcher in me goes, how many more? Mm-hmm. And the point is, there's a group of people that recognize the hunting value. And in fact, some of the land ownership was originally set aside prior to oil and gas for hunters largely out of Chicago. So I think it's part of this story mm-hmm. that's never been told. Now, since you have this real estate, did you ever have market hunters?
Market hunters? You mean
probably.
You mean people shooting to sell?
Right.
Yes.
Definitely. Way back when, yeah. when it was legal.
Yes, when it was legal.
When it was legal, that's one of the things that the Islaños did to supplement their income.
As you look at the history of the duck hunting and the corporation, the duck hunting, as it evolved, was done more by the market hunters in the early days, those people shooting and taking those ducks to
the
French market
to sell.
It wasn't a sporting issue. There's not a whole lot of sporting duck hunting in the early days on a grand scale, not like this.
Just me looking at, mm-hmm. at the data.
What you really had probably back then is more of your trappers that were supplementing their income with the ducks. Jerry Alfonso was a perfect sort of Vic Liberti.
Yeah.
Talk about, getting those French ducks and getting them down to the French market.
And some of the hunters would take orders. People would say, I want 12 French ducks or 12 teal or,
Define a French duck.
Mm-hmm. Quacks. Quacks. Anything that quacks.
Okay. Okay. I've heard
the term. Puddle of duck that quacks.
All right.
It's a puddle of the quacks.
Okay.
The divers aren't French ducks. The pintails aren't French ducks. Quack. So the spoonbill, the mallard, the mottled duck, teal tuna has a stint.
Now, have you ever heard the use of a punt gun?
Yes.
In Louisiana?
I can't say I have heard it in Louisiana.
You know what it is?
Yes. I don't know that they've actually used those here, but I can't say I know that they use that here.
I've only heard one reference that they may have been used here.
I don't.
A punt gun is basically a cannon.
Oh.
Well, it shoots out a lot. You're shooting into, when you look at the development of the duck, and like I said, go back to my great grandfather had the lease that my brother and I use today. Maybe it was even bigger than that then, but he invited people out to hunt, and that was either oil and gas interest or just people who. The plumber that worked on the house, or somebody who liked to go duck hunting.
His doctor.
The lawyers, So, they would have, spots that they called their, but they didn't lease it. They didn't pay anything for it. They just went and hunted, And so there was that little element. The rest of it was pretty much market hunters. We didn't really have a lot of duck leases. And I think it was pretty much after he died that we really started, Mr. Adams started leasing out the ponds mm-hmm. And that's where we got to the 66.
Friends, people who, Islaños, people who lived down there, sports, who wanted to hunt. And Mr. Adams did the negotiating and the leasing, but it was only a handshake.
$100, $200, $300.
And it was nothing written. And when I came on, I felt that that could be dangerous. So
well, it was worse than that. But Donald, it's already took it over. He started leasing the same ponds to two different people because he
didn't know.
He said, "Well, I didn't. That's not where I told him to go." Well, the guy says he's been hunting there for 20 years when Mr. Adam put him there, and now you. Well, he don't need that much. That's not how we're going to do things, Donald. We're gonna make sure that we're, you know, when we give our word, we're gonna stand behind it, you know.
Now,
and that's why we've now got to pull out one. But anyone, it doesn't matter. You'll see that in the lease there is a map now that is got the areas marked off. We even have better maps than that now. Let's see if we can get one more up to date now. There you go. Now we've digitalized them. We know exactly how many. Now you can see the difference. What's happened in this pond? We go back here to this map. Look how this is all opened up.
Yes. Yes.
Up of Oak River.
Yes.
So
now, if we're talking about market hunting, they needed decoys.
Yes.
We sometimes call it folk art or hatchet art.
Yes.
Were there Isleño families?
Absolutely. All of the Isleños in the beginning made their own decoys. They made their own decoys. We have several examples in the museum. They were crude looking, but the ducks didn't know any better, and they worked very well. And then as time went on, it became a folk art, and they were more realistic, more polished, more beautiful. And we just had an exhibit, Ducks, Decoys, and Dacinas at the Ducrow Museum. And we had a wonderful collection of decoys from all over. We had some from Tennessee. They were originally New Orleans, but the guy lives in Tennessee, and he gave us three of his ducks and to leave in the museum. And so it was, you know, we had over 50 or 60 exhibits. And we even had a cardboard decoy. Because at one time they sold these cardboard decoys. And Henry Rodriguez had one left. So we had that in the exhibit too. And it was great. It really was.
Well, Mike, you brought up something that maybe you'd like to comment on just a tad. Go ahead. Are you about to say something? Well,
you asked me about, I don't know if she answered about the decoys. I mean, I know that at the turn of in the early days, that they hunted over wooden decoys. Adam Ansardi, Herd Ansardi carved, Jerry Alfonso's dad carved. I mean, those were all the old carvers. Brian Sheramy from Cut Off the Rose area, he actually did a book a while back, he and along with Dave Hall, that's Ducks, Decoys, and Lures, Legends, Decoys.
Legends.
Something like that. But anyway, he focused on, across all of Louisiana, but southeast, the carvers who carved for the hunt. Not like Jeff Brunet that's doing 20, you give him a $10,000 retainer, and a year and a half from now, you'll get your duck, you know, along with another $15,000.
Is that Tam Brunet's?
That's his son. Jude are the sons. But, you know, we have a great, great history of working decoys. Those right there are Cal Kingsmill decoys, and Cal does I hunt over a set of Cal Kingsmill wood decoys. A couple of years ago, I bought myself 18 decoys to actually hunt over, and we used them the first season, and I break them out once or twice now, but most of the time they stay upstairs in the bag now. But the point was, I'd gone to an auction somewhere, and they were auctioning off these working decoys, and they said, well, this was in so-and-so's string of working decoys, and they'd sell it for $9,000, $900, $1,100. I said, you know, if I bought a set, maybe one day they might be worth something. You know, somebody said, well, this was in Mike Binger's working set of decoys that he actually hunted over.
But that's not insignificant.
You know, no, but it's a great, I mean, it's just a great, great, you know, way. Those two right there are Jerry Alfonso, who used to work for this company. And the one up there with the swings, that's Weldon Bordelon, who's deceased now. That's a Weldon Bordelon.
And he was
Bordelon,
a world champion duck carver.
You know. And then I've got a, up on the second floor in our conference room there, I've got a pretty good set of, a lot of Cal Kingsmills that I picked up at the Ewoks and a few other of the local artists. You could take all the Cal Kingsmills that I have on my shelf, put a string and a weight on and hunt over them. They all float. But I paid too much for those. I just picked up one the other night, and I got stuck with in Slidell two nights ago, you know. They said they sold it for $1,000. Well, that wasn't me. Oh, yeah, Mike Binge bought it, too. Okay. I'd have bid $900. I'd have bid $1,000. John Newman, but he said, oh, you take it.
That's so, just gorgeous. You
know. So
it looks like the feathers would touch them.
That's a cash robin. That's a that is wood. That is wood.
So that's just gorgeous.
Well, the Bordelon did that. That was,
but again, this is the sequential development from
the working. This went from the working decoy to the decorative decoy.
Yeah, from a subsistence-based economy to something more wage-based.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to go back. You mentioned, and I think you're right. The trappers' season was over. They also hunted. It was well. Where does the oysterman fit into this story?
I don't know, to be totally honest with you.
I don't know most either.
Of the oyster leases that I've ever was familiar with were not productive oyster leases. They were oil and gas holdup leases.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the things in our water bottom suits that we had to deal with, you know, because the state was leasing our water bottoms to oyster fishermen who were in turn holding up the oil and gas companies from drilling on our property. And so even though we won that, the state still continues to lease some of those water bottoms. But whenever we have an oil and gas and the call said, don't worry about them. They don't have a leg to stand on. Mm-hmm. We've already got the title from the courts that we own the water bottom. So they may have a lease from the state. That's their problem. You know?
You know, one of the things that both of you can comment about that we should at least touch is how hurricanes in particular has reshaped, and I mean not just from the landscape, but people's attitudes. And you go back to Betsy. You can actually go back before that. You can look at Camille.
1947 storm, I was a senior in high school.
And the 1915 storm played an enormous role in how New Orleans looked at it.
Oh, the 1950 storm? I have a story about that.
Right,
that was one of my bedtime stories that my grandmother used to tell. I lived on Esplanade Avenue. It was in August, and it was very hot. And she would sit in a rocking chair with a fan. I would be in the bed laying down. And she would tell me stories and fan me till I got to sleep. She was a wonderful person. And one of her favorite stories was the 1915 storm. She said that, you know, in those days, there was no warning, no storm warning. And so she said my grandfather had gone taking stuff to the French market, so he wasn't there. And she was at they had a grocery store in Delacroix Island, and she was at the grocery store with the two children. My mother was 5, my aunt was 3. And she said the weather got bad, and it was really, you know, the water was coming up. And her brother had a fishing boat, and he came by the store to get her and the kids. And she told him, I don't want to leave because Manuel won't know where I am when he comes back. And my brother told her, if you don't leave, he won't know where you are because you'll be dead. You've got to come with me. You've got to get on the boat. Well, in the meantime, and he had a big boat, a big shrimping boat. And a lot of people had gathered on the porch because it was elevated and the water was coming up. And so she said, well, I can't leave all these people here, you know. I'm not going to leave, you know, without all these people. And he looked at her and shook her head because she was a very, you know, when she set her mind to something, that was it. And he said, okay, put them in the boat. Let's go. And so they got everybody in the boat, and as they pulled away, the store collapsed.
That's the one I got the other night.
The store collapsed as they pulled away. And they went out, as the Isleños still do, they go out in the boat and they tie up, usually in the trees, and ride out the storm. And she said it was terrible because the snakes were in the trees, because they were getting away from the water too, and they were just dropping into the boat. And she said everybody, when they dropped, they were stunned. She said, we just pick them up and throw them overboard. Get rid of them. And her brother told her, he said, you know, if we hadn't had all those people in the boat, we might not have made it.
Wow.
So that was one of my bedtime stories.
Yeah, but Betsy had to play a real critical role in your property, population at Delacroix.
It did, but
for the moment it was, you know, it was a big event for the moment. But let's face it, everything's going to pale compared to what happened to Katrina.
Oh,
you
yes.
You know, you had the lower Ninth Ward flooded, Al-Arabi, but Violet and Chalmette itself,
and
Violet
and they
Poitras. Poitras never floods. That's why Blackie Campo went there. For Katrina, Poitras never floods. You know, so that was, to me, after Betsy, you still had houses in St. Bernard Parish that were habitable, unaffected. Mm-hmm. You had, of course, you did lose Araby and the Lower Ninth Ward and all of that, but after Katrina, I think there was maybe 7 houses that were habitable.
Only
out of 40,000, 44,000?
I think there were 27,000 houses and businesses in St. Bernard Parish. And I think there were only 5 that were left standing.
It was phenomenal. Whatever.
That were not, you know, devastated by the water and the storm.
Now, about 8 months ago, a little longer, Roy and I interviewed the Roban family. Mm-hmm. It might be a little longer than that. And they said that 11 families had moved back to Delacroix.
That's what I'm hearing too.
Mm-hmm.
One of my employees' parents lived down there. They moved out. You know, they still have the house. They still have a raised house down there, but they're not officially residents down there. So it's more of a weekend camp getaway now down there. Mm-hmm. But that's what I heard about. I thought I heard 8, but 11 could be right. There's not very many people who live there on a permanent basis. One guy who does is not even a local down here. That's Brian Gross. He owns All Fact Specialties. He's single, so he lives.
Well, yeah. I bring this up because I think it's fair to say that in terms of resiliency...
Oh, gosh.
All right?
Yes.
That when you look at not just the Isleño community, but others,
mm-hmm.
it's tattooed to their soul. Mm-hmm. So how can you explain that they're terribly resilient and home is not 5 miles up to Bayou? How do you explain that?
I think that was Blackie Campo. That's definitely Donald and Saudi.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can't get him to leave
during a hurricane.
He rode out Katrina at our field office. Actually, he went to the pump house that was built originally for the pump station because it was raised. Our field office had about a foot and a half, 2 feet of water because the levees broke at Scarsdale. So we, you know, but he's not going out of Plaquemines Parish. He feels that if he leaves, I don't know what he feels.
I mean,
he needs to be there for when the storm's done to check his boats, to help people.
Yeah.
You know, and I said, well, Donald, you cannot. Oh, no, you cannot. You know, he does not evacuate.
He will not.
Thank goodness. Well, because he rebuilt down, and he lives down in Davan, so he rebuilt his house after Katrina. And he rode the storm out down there for Isaac, and thank goodness, because we had 9 feet of water at our field office at Scarsdale for Isaac. So,
yeah,
it was much, much.
Now, Mike, I know where Dave Ann is. Yes. I have no idea where Scarsdale is.
Right below the Belchase Ferry.
Belchase Ferry.
On the west side?
On the east side. On the east side.
You get off the ferry.
The one block of Scarsdale Road.
And it's okay. the first turn. Yeah.
Now,
the pumping station.
When you look at Lake Leary,
okay,
all right, and you look between the western arm of Lake Leary, because it makes this sort of, and you go west to the river,
okay,
there's a whole series of canals that look like that could have been a land reclamation project at one time.
Yes, it was. It was the Carnarvon Drainage District.
Really? Now, do you ever remember piece of real estate called Promised Land?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Explain that to me.
Well, the Promised Land Canal is on our property. That's all I've ever known it is Promised Land. But it does come from the river. There's the Promised Land. They had a Promised Land Academy. The kids all went to school down there.
Leander Perez started the Promised Land Academy when segregation was an issue. And I've always heard of Promised Land. We have a duck lease, a duck area that's called Promised Land.
I always thought that was because they drilled a well that was dry, but that's what that means.
Well,
there's a lot of dry holes.
It was before that.
But there is up on the highway an area called Promised Land on the river highway, and so where that all.
I think it goes back to a land reclamation project.
Mm-hmm.
I think it goes back maybe to the Wisner.
I don't know about that.
And then there's another piece. If you go to
Donald and Saudi might know the history of Promised Land.
If you go to Hopedale, Wycloski and Hopedale, and go due east, there's another area out there that's got a whole rectangle set of canals. And the only reason I can figure that, there are two reasons I could think of. One, it's a land reclamation project for maybe oranges at one time, or it's a muskrat ranch. And I have no record of either, but this is not oil and gas.
Right.
No. This is either trapping, which I tend to think it's a land reclamation project at a time period which we've lost the records.
Yeah. Well, the Carnarvon Drainage District that you're referring back to was a land reclamation project. And unfortunately, when they blew the levee in 1927, they blew the Carnarvon Reclamation Project. But it did actually go through one phase of completion where they had dredged what they called the outer canals. They had the pumping station in there, and there's still remnants of that pumping station out there, if you know where to look for it. And they had some lateral canals, and they had some canals they never dug. And then there was a bigger picture of it for a stage two that was going to go even further into the marsh, probably all the way to Lake Leary. But that never happened.
Mm-hmm. How hard is it to find a pump station? Do you need a boat? Can you do it for
you got a boat.
All right.
Yeah.
Now, what keeps the population so glued to the land on Terrebonne?
It's in their blood. It's a part of them.
Is it fair to say it's home?
It's home. It's home.
I think when you know, Blackie Campo said the same thing after, you know, I said, look, I didn't matter, and I was miserable.
Uh-huh.
We couldn't wait to get back down there to Shell Beach. Dred, you know, fished his fuel tanks out of the marsh, cleaned them out with a garden hose, rushed them into the bayou. EPA came by and asked me, well, how do you clean them out here? Oh, don't tell us that. Don't tell us that. Never mind, forget we asked the question. But he was back up selling diesel to the shrimpers who were back out catching shrimp after Katrina. You know? It's just their way of life. You know, that's what they know. They know the boats, they know the water, they know shrimping, they know crabbing, they know the oysters. You know, that's what they do.
And when did your family first settle this area?
Well, our ancestors came over from the Canary Islands on 1778, and they were settled in St. Bernard Village, where the museum is today. That's where that group of settlers from the Canary Islands settled. There were other settlers who were settled around Gonzales and...
The name of the Iberian?
But that wasn't as late as. They were from Malaga, and they were earlier. But the Isleños were settled in four areas around the city to protect the city from British invasion. That was their purpose. And the only settlement to really survive intact and maintain its cultural identity is the one in St. Bernard.
So is it fair to say, and I did some mathematics, it's only rough, 11 generations?
I guess.
The family's been, but not the company. The company.
No, the family.
The family, yeah.
And what percent of those 11 generations lived within 30 miles of the original site? Rough number.
I really
Until 1920, all of them.
Yeah. All of them. And then really until World War II. It wasn't until after World War II that the Isleños began to assimilate into New Orleans, and because of the training they had received in the military, then they could get jobs in the city, and many of them still had jobs in the city and lived in the parish. You know,
my great grandfather was one of the first to leave because he could afford to buy a house on Esplanade Avenue.
That was after the 1915 storm.
You know, so
he put the two girls in Holy Angels Academy, and they rented first.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they built the house on Esplanade in 1927.
Wow. Now the tough one. Michael, I'm assuming you have some children. Do you want your kids to live here?
Do I want them to stay? I do, absolutely.
Absolutely.
They do, and they do.
Okay.
My oldest daughter's a lawyer. She's got three children. My youngest daughter is at LSU. I have a feeling she'll stay somewhere close to home.
Well, I think it's again, going back to this resiliency.
Yeah.
This whole concept of, I understand the importance of having your parents and your grandparents. I didn't have that because my background is worse than shotgun shells. So I've had to learn that you want your children, grandchildren, maybe even your great-grandchildren. I mean, when we have a family get-together, there are three generations, and I'm the patriarch of that group. And you want to continue whatever the traditions are.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that we can find many places in this country that's a true statement. So when you articulate that, and if somebody in Boise, Idaho listens to this, they're going to be somewhat surprised. Now, we've been doing this for an hour and a half, and I know there's some other things. I do want to talk about rum running, but maybe we need to do that another day. Would that be fair? Because I understand the importance of being in the outdoors, right? But we would love to come back.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. You now know the kinds of things mm-hmm. we're interested in.
Mm-hmm.
If you would have, like, I don't want a copy of a confidential document, but if you have one that's not signed,
mm-hmm.
with no check or anything,
I'll give you that too.
We can just make a copy. Mm-hmm. This is an example.
Mm-hmm.
We like to let people know that we don't want to be a pest.
Mm-hmm.
We would like to be a guest at, what is this, 204? 206.
206. Decatur Street.
And come down, and if you find imagery or anything you think is unimportant, show us.
Mm-hmm.
And let me explain why, and then it's time to go. When I was putting together the book Washed Away, I was really interested in the canning business. We don't have enough information. And I found an oyster can, and I just wanted to get it and photograph it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I bid, counterbid, bid, counterbid, bid, and there's only so much nickels in my nickel book. I got to about $125, and I figured my wife would not be real happy with me spending that for an old can. It sold for $2,275. Okay. Now, it takes two people. Mm-hmm. So even an old can. Again, we don't want the original. If you can sell it, please do. Mm-hmm. Let us get a photograph of it. Because the artwork was incredible. The company is still here in Louisiana, although their headquarters has moved to Atlanta. I'm going to try to go to Atlanta on a cold call and just visit and see if they may have... I don't want the original. And if they're worried about copyright, I'll do it in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
Because it gives you the name of a place. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you an example. There was a place called Dunbar, Louisiana. And it's actually Dunbar, Lopez, and Decate Seafood Company. And I'm a geographer. I'm supposed to know. Couldn't find it. Another place called Lookout. Couldn't find it. About 3 weeks ago, I got a little upset with myself. Mm-hmm. Well, if you go to the post office, you can find out if they had postal records.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Lookout went from 1896 to 1915. Dunbar went from 1916 to 1930. And I go, it's got to be the same site.
Mm-hmm.
I found a map.
Mm-hmm.
I found it. Now, I have to, only way I knew that place was there
was because of the can.
Can said canned at Dunbar.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
So anything you think is not mm-hmm. important, it could be real important. Because what we find is what's common to you, the rest mm-hmm. of the world doesn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're trying to do. And I think I speak for Roy. We really appreciate you doing this.
Okay.
And we will get back to rum running.
Mm-hmm.
I have some questions.
Okay.
I don't know a whole lot about it.
Brian Gowlin did his dissertation at Southeastern on the Trappers' War.
Okay.
He gave me a copy.
All right.
And in fact, we were supposed to meet the day Katrina hit to go over pictures so that we could publish it. And he said that we could, in other words, he would let us publish it, and we could sell it as funds for the museum.
Really?
And I've got to get back with him before something happens to him or me, so we can get that done.
Well, I think, I can't say for sure, but we may have some capability of putting it in a digital format.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have to discuss this. There may be a possibility
mm-hmm.
If that would help.
Oh, yeah.
There are things we can do.
Uh-huh.
And I like to remind people the biggest bureaucracy in Louisiana is not state government, it's uh-huh. LSU.
It's LSU. Okay.
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 All right.
That sounds good.
Roy?
Okay. Okay.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
And if you catch some fish, I hope they're big.
I'm not going to fish till next Tuesday. I'm a